Okay, so what I'm going to be doing in this talk, which essentially is loosely based on this review article that I wrote for Mario's Proceedings, for which all the credit for the work really goes to these collaborators who are named there, Jean-Marc, Luc, Johannes, thank you, Johannes Berg, and Gary Barker, and I just present the talks. So what I'm going to do here is sort of run you through some reviews of the stuff that we've done on vibrated sand, and these are some numerical results which might be familiar to some of you, but perhaps not all of you. Go very quickly into some extremely recent work that we've done on the statistics of arches and bridge geometries. Talk about granular compaction in the limit of jamming by a random graphs model, and then, in fact, and for this I thank Meenakshi, say something about how shape matters in granular compaction. So with that introduction, let me just say my introductory slide is extremely introductory, and its main purpose is really to tell those people who work on avalanches that, you know, I have worked on them and I would love to have private discussions with them on this, but this talk is not going to be about avalanches, and I don't think I need to say anything more about avalanches here. Okay, so first of all, a review of our work on numerical approaches to vibrated sand. Well, a very, very, very long time ago when we got into this business, we thought of actually setting up a Monte Carlo scheme which had two main ingredients, stochasticity and cooperativity, to model the vibration of a bed of sand. So this is a typical schematic setup in three dimensions, and the two main ingredients are that when we have a bunch of particles, what we do is we dilate the assembly, and what we then do is we say that the dilation is in proportion to some number epsilon, okay, which a typical grain will move in proportion, you know, during the dilation, and that, if you like, is a measure of the amplitude of vibration. We say therefore that, you know, you kick a system upwards and each grain moves some number epsilon. If epsilon is one, it moves through its own radius. If it's a half, it moves through half its radius, and so on. It's just a way of parameterizing how we do it. And then, importantly, when these grains are up in the air, then basically we allow them stochastic displacements, because we are, after all, not, it's very boring to have all the grains go up and all the grains come down together. So we say that, you know, well, it leads to neat results, but it's a bit boring. So what we say is we say that there is a stochastic displacement of grains in the air, which is proportional to also to epsilon or epsilon square, I forget quite which, in the axial direction. In other words, these things get completely jumbled up midair, and then when they descend, and this is the word, this is where the word hybrid comes in. We, unlike what was done before us, which was again a very long time ago, allow grains which wish to descend together to form arches to do so. That's what I mean by the inclusion of cooperative structures. If things were strictly sequential, arches would never form. So our whole, you know, our whole aim was to see that if we have stochasticity, if we have these cooperative structures, is that a reasonable model of, you know, the structures that we get in, you know, when we vibrate sand. And as they say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So very early on, we got some results, which at least in those prehistoric days, because this is way back in 1990, 1991, when some of you were not even born, then we actually found in those days that you know, this graph got noticed and got picked up by science and so on. And the reason was, something we hadn't even thought, we hadn't realized what the great, this looks to me like a very boring graph, but believe me, what science picked up on was this 0.58, this number, is something to which you can get by sequential deposition. Okay, so let me first say, what is this? This is the plot of volume fraction against shake intensity. Again, let me remind you that 0.5 means typically a grain moves through its radius, okay, during the vibration. So what this is saying is, as you decrease the vibration intensity, you increase the volume fraction. So far, no surprises, and this looks surprisingly like the reversible branch of Sid-Nagel's compaction curves. And so and in those days, we'd completely discarded the irreversible branch in those days, because we just were interested in the steady state that you got. Okay, but what people picked out was that, you know, at 0.58, this was the maximum value to which you get if you only have sequential deposition. We, however, had gone higher. So this was a clue to us to say that somehow, probably our inclusion of cooperative effects had allowed us to, you know, to jam better. Okay, so that's the part that I want to call your attention to. I'm glad, again, that Meenakshi brought up the issue of contact numbers, because this thing, which you can barely see and which we can talk about afterwards, is a distribution of contacts in a typical shaken setup, and it's, you can barely see it here, so I don't want to talk about it right now. But this, again, is a plot of the mean coordination number against the shake intensity. Okay, and one of the things you see is that the range here is between 4.45 and 4.65. So in some sense, you know, we're I mean, take a gentleman's average. I mean, the mean coordination number is something like 4.5, and this is very different from 6. Okay, so basically, it's very different from the isostatic case. And in those days, you know, we didn't do ND, so we didn't dare to say that we included friction or anything like this. But I think now with the ND simulations of Silbert et al., and also with a little bit of common sense, it seems that, you know, these arches and things that we have in our packings, they're really only going to be stable if you have some amount of friction. I'm not talking about the limit of complete friction or no friction, but something in between, which is a hard case. So this is something which tells us that, fine, we didn't know ND, but the structures that we get seem to give results which are consistent with some value of friction. Yeah.
Are those values measured stationarily?
Yes.
You repeat the task.
Absolutely. 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 Everything. Yes, yes, yes. In fact, that's exactly, and thank you for pointing that out, Mary. I mean, everything we do has been done to death. You know, so, you know, I mean, you know, you repeat it forever and you take many, many ensembles and then you take averages, and all credit for that goes not to someone as impatient as me, but to Gary Barker, who's infinitely more patient.
Did you explain the numerical scheme?
I did already, but can I come back to that? The numerical scheme is simply that you dilate all the grains, okay?
I understood.
Yeah.
How do you take into account the arch formation?
Okay, basically what you do is when things are up in the air, okay, you just have a list of all the particles. When something is coming down, you see the probability of it wanting to land in position X. You see the probability of something else wanting to land in position X. If it was sequential, one of these would have to go after the other. But in our thing, we just allow them to land together. So in two dimensions, I would just say two of these guys land and they, you know, they sit on two neighbors. If they both want to land at X, we let them. That's how we form them. And then the question is, if you just make these structures, are they stable? And then you repeat the thing to death and you see what are the stable arches. And I'll come more to that in what follows. Yeah.
So you don't have an explicit value for friction coefficient?
No, nothing at all.
You allow this.
Absolutely. There is no friction.
Doesn't it mean that you have intense friction? You basically allow it.
It's not as simple as that, because what we do is that when things land, we allow the substrate to reorganize. Okay? So in other words, it's not like we say these things stick and they're stuck forever. What they do is they form part of the substrate. But now another guy falls on top of this structure. He might topple the ones below him. So every time we do this, the whole substrate is reorganizing. If it were infinite friction, things would be jammed.
What are the rules? When exactly this rearrangement occurs?
Well, the rearrangement occurs when we have a drop and roll dynamics, okay? And when something finds a position of local stability, we let it stick. But then n plus 1 comes along. Okay? And then it might destroy that and rearrange that. So in other words, we go through one whole cycle where all n particles land.
So do you follow the forces? Or
no, we don't have any forces in this.
So it's just
geometrical stability.
Local geometrical stability. So how exactly, by adding one more particle, can it destroy anything?
What it can do is it can supposing you have a bridge which is sort of marginally stable, supposing it's stable, or suppose, but you have something else which is landing on the right-hand side of it. I would rather go to this in the discussion, but supposing it's landing on the right-hand side of that, it also wants to be in this, let's say in two dimensions, three things want to sit on two grains. That's not stable. So maybe the middle one will fall through. Okay, but let's go to the algorithm later, because this is only the introduction to the introduction to the introduction, and I don't want to be caught in a never-ending loop. Okay, so one of the things that we then do is we've done this in two dimensions where it's easier to visualize, but a very simple thing, which in fact has been brought up earlier here by Jean-Noël Roux, is that, you know, what exactly is the effect of large and small vibration? Remember, my talk is called Compaction in the Jamming Limit, okay? So I really am interested in the effects of low vibrations. What happens at those volume fractions below above 0.58? So here's just a typical ensemble of spheres. I draw the contact network. This is the original contact network, okay? So just believe me when I tell you that all of these, this contact network represents that. And now I would ask you to guess which of those two pictures correctly represents the effect of low vibration. And, you know, even for someone as myopic as me, I would say that this is the one after low vibration. When you see more or less that the topology has been preserved, okay, whereas here the topology has been completely destroyed. What am I trying to say by that? I'm trying to say that if I really give something a very big whack, people lose their neighbors, you know, they reform contacts and so on. Whereas if I jiggle things very gently, then probably some of these contact networks are deformed, but they're not destroyed. Why am I saying all of this? I'm saying this because I'm proposing, or we have proposed, the mechanism for compaction above that 0.58 value. Okay? Remember, above 0.58, there is not much room for a single grain to move up or move down. There isn't enough pore space. Okay? So what these things are trying to do is they're trying to say we have a bunch of bridges where in our packed granular media. We're trying to tap the assembly. When we do that, what we're doing is that these bridges maintain their neighbors. They deform, but they deform in such a way that, is there any chalk here? So if I have a bridge which is very space-wasting in some way, these guys try to move down so that their positions, their new positions, trap less void space. And one requirement for keeping this mechanism of deformation is that a grain's neighbors stay almost the same. So in this plot, you have an autocorrelation function of a grain versus time, and this lower graph corresponds basically to large vibration intensities, and you see that the autocorrelation function decreases very rapidly, whereas the top one corresponds to low vibration intensities. In this regime, grains keep their neighbors, and as I showed in that cartoon over there, what's basically happening is a grain keeps his neighbors around him, and things move oppositely to each other in the longitudinal direction, because we have gravity in our simulations, in such a way that they collapse and they trap void space. In this graph, which you can hardly see, this is a graph of the displacement correlations of grains in the longitudinal direction in the presence of gravity. There are, in fact, two graphs here. Ignore the one with the wiggles. Just concentrate on the one which actually goes down. How do I say anticorrelations? There's a value of zero here, and if you could see this graph better, which I apologize for in terms of the graphics, what it's saying is that for very low vibrational intensities, there are grains which at a certain distance z from each other are collapsing onto each other. That's the meaning of the anticorrelations. And that is something I'll come back to. I beg your pardon? That's g of z, which is this longitudinal displacement correlation. It just says, if I'm a grain here, what is the grain displacement at distance z from me? Okay? And so we're saying that a major mechanism, or the major mechanism, depending on your point of view, near jamming is bridge collapse, because sharper bridges, and this is where your contact angle distributions are things we've also looked at, they collapse to become flatter bridges. Because remember, grains can't move. All you can do is minimize void space.
Yes, I'm a bit uncomfortable with your claim that at low vibration, at low vibration you fix the topology. If I'm thinking about just two particles in a bench, mm-hmm. they're sort of classical simple which can form a bridge, and then our start vibration is probably quite natural. You can check it. Eventually one of them will fall down, so the topology will change.
But we're not being contradictory here. What I'm saying is that what the situation that you're referring to is precisely the one that I've described, except what you're doing is you're taking 10,000 time steps. What I'm saying is, initially, I'm not saying the topology is never changed. Even if you look at my graphs, you'll find that basically the topology will deform. But eventually what will happen is, exactly as you've described, off those two, you know, they'll go down, 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 and in the limit of perfect jamming, one of those will fall. So I'm not, you know, I'm not contesting that, because that, after all, is how jamming occurs.
If that is the picture, yeah, then I would claim that basically you destroy all the frictional contacts.
Well, let's go into that discussion later. Let's go into the discussion of friction later, because we've already had this discussion before. I just wanted to tell you that the displacement correlations in the horizontal plane do not depend on vibration intensity. This, for those people who were listening to it while I was having my mini discussion, is just a picture of the void space. So you take the space of pores outside the space of grains, and you find that as the vibration intensity decreases, the pore space gets connected, which makes a lot of sense, which is why you can have more transport if you do that. These are extremely old results, so let's not spend any time on them. What I did want to say was a word on crystallization, and what we have found, and these graphs essentially show it, is that for a very narrow range of vibrational intensities, this is volume fraction being plotted on the y-axis, and this is time on the x-axis, and what we find is that for essentially vibration intensities in our formalism of order 0.4, 0.5, 0.6, which, as Meenakshi pointed out the other day, is, you know, displacements typically of the order of a particle radius, we actually do tend to see spontaneous crystallization occurring. It's just something I leave there for discussion, because, as you'll see from my talk, these are kind of thumbnails, and people are welcome to come and bother me and harass me to give them more details, but right now I don't want to bore those of you who don't want to be harassed. Okay, so here what we've done is, I'm trying to show you what actually happens when you have one of those jumps in crystallization. This is the original configuration, and here you can see clearly that ordering has occurred. You can analyze this more if you wish by using correlation functions. We just didn't do that. I'm now going to jump to my second topic, which is once you have these bridges, this is very recent stuff, so there's no chronological unity, but there is thematic unity, so I'm bringing it forward. Once you actually have these arches and bridges in a vibrated bed, one of the things you can wonder is how, is there a way of identifying them, of classifying them, doing anything with them? And this is not for the unadventurous. Okay, my colleague Gary Barker basically found a way of identifying what these bridges are, how you can define them, and indeed then classifying them. And he classified them in the most simple way possible as simple. And in the next slide, I'm going to have complex bridges. Why simple? Because if I draw, remember, sorry, this is actually sitting in a bed of particles. It's not just hanging there anti-gravity. Okay, so just so that you know that, we've picked out this bridge and we've looked at its contact network. And as you see here, it's essentially linear. Okay, in other words, it has absolutely no loops, whereas complex bridges have loops. And as far as I'm concerned, complex bridges I could just almost forget about in terms at this moment anyway, in terms of trying to do any theory. And here are just some results. We've, apart from the hard sphere simulations, Jean-Marc Luc and I did some theory on it, which was pure phenomenology, which was the equivalent of doing the tube model in polymers, where you take a highly complex dynamical problem, and then you look at how the structures are with respect to some kind of an arc length, and really, if there's any justice in the world, your results should not agree. Ours did, and we didn't cheat, so I leave that up to you. So what we find here is that linear bridges are exponentially distributed, okay, which again, to us, rang echo of these exponential distributions of forces. They look like self-avoiding walks with dimensionality between 2 and 3, because in a three-dimensional setup, you would imagine that these, you know, linear chains would sort of propagate in a way that was not planar, but which is also not necessarily three-dimensional. Complex bridges look like 3D percolation clusters, and most large bridges, which is of n greater than or equal to 8, where n is the number of particles, look like 3D percolation clusters, and we have exponents for mean square length, for distributions, for all sorts of things.
Define a little bit what a bridge is.
Okay, a bridge is a structure where any two of the particles rely on each other for their lateral stability. Okay, so it's not like a tetrahedron is a counter example of a bridge. Okay. And I can, you know, I can go into chapter and verse, you know, afterwards. And this is just a sort of thumbnail. And so let me just go through this, and I'll, you know, it's very easily definable.
What's the typical value of n?
You know what? The typical value of n is something that's as large as your patient and your simulation sizes. So, for example, if you have, all of these things are for roughly 2,000 particles, and you have tails of ridges. We've looked at them to n equals 15 or 16. Okay. Beyond that, to really the way in which these ridges are made, I wanted to skip all this detail, but you know, if you have a bunch of coordinates, it's just arbitrary. But if you run your simulation often enough and you see the dynamics of how these things settle, you then identify which the real bridges are. Okay? Once you do that, you then get statistics on them by running the thing over and over again. Okay? Then bridges like n equals 16, n equals 17 are present but rare. But if you had a huger simulation, you would have more. Okay.
You mean when you say is you find 16 isolated particles in a chain?
Not necessarily in a chain. Remember, they could be complex bridges. In fact, at that point, there's hardly any in a chain, beyond n equals 8 for us.
Without loops.
Without loops.
This means
in a
chain line.
Yeah, before n equals 8. You see what I'm saying? After n equals 8, you start getting these loops. I mean, for our simulations. I don't want to swear by these numbers because, you know, the numbers could change if you did a bigger simulation. I'm just saying what we got in ours. Okay.
If number n equals 16 or 20 even, then you can really define a dimension d between 2 and
3? No. Here what I've said is after n equals 8, complex bridges, which are the ones with loops, dominate. So then they look like percolation clusters. The things that I'm saying look like self-avoiding walks are for n less than 8. See, so that, it's very clear that you would hardly be likely to have a long. In fact, that's a very interesting point to make because in the experiments of To et al. In PRL, who actually started our interest in this business, they were claiming that all bridges were like random walks. You know, so they.
I'm only wondering that. I mean, if you have such short object, n equals 8 or 10, that you are able to identify a dimension between 2 and 3. This is surprising.
No, if you do it often enough, I'm not swearing by. Okay, when I said a dimension between 2 and 3, what am I basing it on? I'm basing it on the mean square length and the distribution of bridges. Okay, and we look at these objects, we compare with all the things we know. What is an SAW? What is a percolation cluster? And these, you know, the figures we have, which I can give you later in detail, suggest that they are like SAW between 2 and 3. I'm still not out of my numerical stuff, and I'm dying to get out of it, so let me just carry on. So asymptotically, what we say is that our theory predicts that long linear bridges form domes. Okay, a dome is like so, it has a flat base, and we also predict that linear bridges grow diffusively in the vertical direction, which is in agreement with the two-dimensional experiments of these people. But what we've added to in three dimensions is that the growth of them in the horizontal direction is super diffusive. Okay? The distribution of something that I'm calling a base extension, which I've actually defined here, which is I take a typical bridge and I map its span into the horizontal direction, and I'm calling that B. So it's, if you like, the base extension of the bridge. It has this funny form, and it seemed a little bit suggestive to us, and that's all I really want to say at this moment, that if you look at the distribution of experimentally obtained normal forces in shaken granular media, which are part of the Chicago experiments, they actually look not too dissimilar. You could argue that, you know, any two graphs could be picked out of the literature to look like any two others. However, the only similarity that I'm kind of interested by is that our base extensions are the objects through which the forces in any force chains would be transmitted. Okay, so it's just a speculation that, as far as we're concerned, linear bridges may be an alternative way of looking at force chains. They're more easily visualizable, and maybe some people would, you know, find them easier to measure. It is not something that I'm saying with any more emphasis than that, because the bridges as structures stand in their own right.
But what is the connection between length and force?
I will come to that.
As far as I remember this graph,
yes.
As I recognize it, these systems were not shaken.
They were shaken.
These were soft grains that were.
But they were shaken before. They were shaken before, then they were compressed, and then they were deformed. Some of them were deformable and some of them were not.
Well, but these ones actually, it's a 37% deformation limit.
Yeah,
so I think shaking is probably not so important.
Well, all I'm saying, okay, One of the ways, you're quite right, that's a very important point. One of the things that we're saying is that these bridges which are stable structures which remain, are things that have persisted in the limit of large amounts of shaking for us. We can say that you need some amount of deformation for these force chains to hold together. Our structures too are stable. We don't have friction, but they are stable because implicitly of this object called friction or deformation. Otherwise, they wouldn't be stable at all. And in any case, it's just a speculation that you can either choose to look at force chains which are hard to measure, or you can look at the objects through which they're transmitted. So that's an alternative. Okay, so how much time do I have? Can I have 15 minutes more? Is that?
Yeah.
15? Okay, I'll be done. So now I'm jumping, and these are literally thumbnails. Please come and please ask me your questions afterwards. This is a completely different way of looking at vibrated sand in the jamming limit. And this is something that was suggested to me by Johannes Berg, who said that, you know, one of the things that I was very interested in doing at one point is I was very tired of lattice models, and I was very tired of off-lattice simulations, and I wanted to look at something which was off-lattice but still tractable. And so, and here, to boot, you can have on a random graph, you can have full disorder with finite connectivity. So what am I talking about? I'm saying that each of these arrows or spins you see here represents a grain. Okay? If it's down, it means one orientation. If it's up, it means another one. Okay? And I can have an arbitrary structure like this on which I place my grains. We then use something which many people here, such as Mario and David, would know as the three-spin model, where essentially what we're saying is that we look at three-spin interactions at a time, and we're saying that, here you can see very clearly, that if all three are plus, it's a satisfied plaquette. If two are minus and one is plus, it's also a satisfied plaquette. But if you have minus, plus, minus, it's an unsatisfied plaquette, just along the rules of that Hamiltonian. Okay? And one of the nice things is that if you have this random graph structure, you actually can define an average coordination number because the connectivities in space are actually fluctuating. I mean, some spins just happen to be connected to many more, some spins are connected to fewer. Okay? And what we're doing here is we're saying the need to minimize this volume, and this is, of course, where the Edwards hypothesis comes in. I'm writing a Hamiltonian, but I'm meaning a volume. And the need to minimize this leads to frustration. Why? Because the global ground state for this three-spin Hamiltonian would be plus, plus, plus. Okay? But it's going to be, and that for me is the crystalline heaven to which all of us aspire, and some of us get knocked in the head for aspiring there. But locally, states such as minus, minus, plus, etc. are also good. And locally, plaquettes will form in that way. So the competition that emerges is that if I look at a state like minus, plus, minus, and I say it's an unfavored state or a void, okay, then this this V Hamiltonian that we had before is trying to minimize those unfavored states, but the competition between global and local void minimization in this model is what leads to slow dynamics. And essentially all I'm doing here is I'm saying that if I actually want to go from one of these black states, which are the favored states of the Hamiltonian, to another one, I have to pass through one of these unfortunate void trapping states. So two spin flips are required to take the plaquette from one metastable state to another. An energy barrier has to be crossed. And then I go back to my favorite example of bridge collapse, which is that, you know, typically if you want to go from one ordered configuration to another in granular media, you need to go through bridges. This is just the way we model tapping. And I think, let me take that in the questions, because it's really modeled basically as you would expect. You have a dilation phase and a quench phase. Let me just go quickly to the results. The results that we see in this model are that if we plot density against the number of taps, we start with a very loosely packed configuration. Robin, in reality, this would be something like 0.57 or 0.56, where things are just barely connected. Where, in short, there is enough space for a grain or a spin to come to a locally optimal position without the help of anybody else. Okay, so this is what I call the single particle relaxation regime, where essentially every grain who can, you know, minimize its local energy with respect to its immediate neighbors, it'll do that. Okay? So this is what I call the fast dynamic regime. This is what I call the single particle relaxation threshold, because beyond this, if one brain wants to move, he has to change some of his neighbors. He's got to convince his neighbors. And this, in fact, we haven't shown it here, but this leads to the famous log T relaxation, and which you have seen in an experiment. And at the end, at the densely packed regime, we had system-wide density fluctuations, where a slight jiggle of one grain can give rise to system-wide density fluctuations. This is what kind of interested us, because Ed Novak, when he moved out of Chicago and went to, I don't know where, but he worked with Mike Weissman,
Delaware.
Yeah, and he worked with Mike Weissman. That's you know, this is the work that I'm talking about. So, yeah, you're right, Delaware. They came up with this stuff, which, you know, when I looked at it in the experiment, I'm sure that I didn't understand it. But Johannes Berg, again, very lucky with my collaborators, he took their data and he tried to see if ours could replicate what they had seen. So let me just explain. This is not the experimental data, but the experimental data looks virtually identical. This is our data, and these are the traces of the density fluctuations in the most, you know, near the jamming limit, you know, at the right-hand extreme of my earlier slide. This regime is what I'm showing there as a top trace. This is when you decompose the noise power, which is the Fourier transform, the density fluctuations, into different octaves of frequency. The reason that the experimentalists did this is they wanted to show that at certain points you had system-spanning fluctuations, okay? So fluctuations at all length and time scales in the density fluctuations near the jamming limit. And what we were able to do is, first, we replicate what the experimental data is. Then we see what's happening in our model. And in our model, what we found was that the reason you have these system-wide density fluctuations is that one grain reorientation, or flip, causes a chain reaction or a cascade over all lengths and timescales, which is what, for us, leads to the agreement with experiment. What I should say here is this agreement, which you see here, it's not an, I mean, don't just have to take my word for it and say, okay, you know, it looks like the traces, because we all know, you know, generating traces like this is extremely easy. But what we did and what the experimentalists did is to plot things like correlation matrices, cross-correlation matrices. We got agreement that was quantitative with what they had to offer, so that's the only reason that I'm saying that. So for me, the thing to take away from the slide is that at the jamming limit, you have system-size wide density fluctuations because grains release other grains and correlations propagate over all scales. Okay, so there is something here on amplitude cycling and how it's possible to get good results from that via a model, but I think I'll give that a miss. So now I'm getting to my last topic, which is the effect of shape. Okay, the effect of shape is something that we've explored using models in a lattice. So if there is a cheat, then this is it. But let me just sort of tell you where it originated. The simplest model which Peter Stadler, Jean-Marc Luc and I came up with was we wanted to use cellular automata models to model the shaking of a box of sand. So you have n times m sites in a box, and each grain has two possible orientations. The reason for that slanty one is just to say that if this guy is given a little kick to get him through that barrier, he's just going to want to fall. But contrary-wise, as Alice would say, if this person wants to come up here, they have an energy barrier of delta capital H plus delta little h. In other words, this is the ordered state, or the favored state, this is the disordered state. Okay? So in this model, this original model, which I'm not going to talk about here, grains can fall, you know, if there's a void below them. They can fly, as you would expect, all depending on the intensity of vibration, and of course they can flip. The thing to remember in this model, or all such models, is that for those of you who remember the princess who felt the pee under many mattresses, basically, if you have the lower down you are in the box or in the column, the more hindered you are by the weight of the grains above you from flipping at all. Okay, if you're on the surface, you can flip easily, but if you're way below, you can't. And through this very simple model, which still says nothing about the effective shape, we get what we call the glassy within quotes, the intermediate, and the fluidized regimes. Let me tell you what these are. These are time traces with the same start configuration. The black grains are disordered as in vertical. The pink grains are ordered as in horizontal. And very soon, you start seeing that if you whack the system with an intensity gamma, you get a fluidized state in one case, and you get in another case, something which looks very, very glassy, which looks glassy but isn't, as I'm going to tell you in a minute, where order starts propagating from the only place it can, which is from the surface. Okay, so but the glassy regime isn't really glassy, because it turns out that if you're only worried about how many grains there are above you, and you're not correlated in the orientations of grains, I mean, my orientation is not affected by those above me, it's not really glassy. So this is what led us to...
So you mean that in those three cases, just a matter of time scale, sense that...
No, it's not a matter of time scale. It's a matter of... those three cases, it's a matter of how much available energy you have to the system. It's not a matter of time scale, because the fluidized regime would never go to the glassy one. But I'm saying the glassy regime is bad, because it shows, you know, it shows all the characteristics like aging and stuff like this. We have graphs which look very glassy, but it can't be right, because, you know, essentially, if my grain doesn't care about the orientations, if there are no long-range interactions, how can I call it a glassy one? It gives me the signatures for reasons I still don't understand, and we can talk about that later.
That's
but
it has a glass, not a glass, just
the oh yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I misunderstood you to mean that between the three regimes, it was a question of time scale. But here, it's a mysterious. It has these glassy signatures, but they're wrong. So that's when we decided to kind of change the nature of the model. So now we said that
sir.
Okay. So this is where there is a gamma there, which I'm going to come to in the next slide, which is a vibration intensity. When it is large, then any starting state becomes fluidized very quickly.
So that the lower one is large gamma.
That's right. And the top one is low gamma. Okay, and you can get signatures of what happens in each regime. We followed the behavior of the packing fraction. In this case, we've looked at aging curves, but that's, you know, that's a whole different talk. And I can, you know, I can tell you what we've got privately, but these are just thumbnails. It's just to say that you can have a model of sand shaking in a box where you interpolate between these three different regimes. That's all I'm saying. But the glassy regime isn't right, and that's the thing. Since this talk is on the jamming limit, that's the thing I wanted to modify. Yeah.
It's not really surprising, is it, that the lower gamma, the rate of change is much less?
Not at all. I mean, I'm not, okay, this is an introduction. It's not, the surprise isn't here. The surprise is in the next slide. Okay, I'm just saying that this model is something we set up to say you can make a model where you have glassy and intermediate regimes and fluidized regimes, and there is no surprise here at all. It's just a description. Okay. The surprise is only that at low gamma, when you have something which looks glassy and has some of the signatures associated with glassiness, that it comes out of a model which has no interactions. That is what is very surprising. And that, I mean, to me it's very dubious. So that's why we went into the last part of my talk, which is, supposing I am in this famous glassy regime, what I'm assuming is that grains will not fly, they will not be displaced. The only thing that a grain can do in the highly jammed limit is reorient. Okay? And now here I'm saying, therefore, let me focus on a column. Let me forget about all the other columns because they're not going to interchange grains anyway. And now, this is the part at which I would appeal for your attention, where I would say that the disordered grain, with the disordered orientation of grain, I'm attaching a number epsilon, which is just a measure of the void space that it traps. So when it's flat, it doesn't trap any void space. When it's vertical, it traps some void space. This is a cheat, because in reality, if epsilon is 0.03675, there will be more than two states. Okay, as a result, it's a cheat. But it's a cheat that works. And I'm describing it to you in that spirit. So here, my claim is that irrational epsilon, which is a number like 0.032756, represents the effect of an irregular grain. You would imagine that the void space left by a grain which had irrational epsilon, it's likely to be an irregular grain. And rational epsilon is for regular grains. And the results were bear this out, but for the moment I ask you to believe me. I can write down a transition probability for the change of orientation, which has essentially two terms. There's one term which describes the earlier effect, which is the lower down you are in the pile, exponential minus n, the more hindered you are from doing anything. So even whatever you do, if you're at the bottom of a pile, you're probably dead, you can't do anything. And then there's another term, which is a ratio of some number that I'm calling hn over the intensity variable gamma. Okay, what is this hn? Hn is something that I'm defining as follows. It's epsilon, which is a void space, times the number of disordered grains. So it's the total void space, minus the total number of ordered grains above me. So mn plus are the number of ordered grains above me, mn minus are the number of disordered grains above me. So this number is saying, this is the total amount of void space that my superiors have already wasted, and this is the number of ordered grains that exist above me. And actually, the reason I came to this funny form is I looked back at my Bible in this business, which is Brown and Richards, 1969, where they define an object called the excess void space, which in fact has exactly this form. So what we were trying to say is, let us balance, let us assume that apart from the simply, you know, mass-driven effect, too many people above me means I can't move, how can I couple the orientations? One way of coupling the orientations is saying all the free surface, all the freedom of movement is at the free surface on top of me. If the guys above me have been economical, I can reorient, okay? But if they haven't, I can't. Why from top? Because that's where all the motion comes from. So here what we find is that the transition from order to disorder of a grain is hindered by the number of voids above it. And now I just want you to see for the moment what actually happens, that as soon as epsilon is irrational, that HN number, this is always non-zero. In other words, you can define, and it comes out of the formalism, the ground state is unique and it happens to be quasi-periodic, but for rational epsilon, P over Q, you can actually have the vanishing of H. What does that really mean? And I'm going to show you an example of that very quickly. It means that perfect packing can happen when the number of grains is a multiple of the period P plus Q if epsilon is P over Q. This leads to ground states that are highly degenerate, and I'll give you an example of that. For regular grains, for example, if epsilon is a half, then you can think of plus minus minus as a configuration where two disordered grains, which waste half the void space of, you know, of which is the size of an ordered grain, half the size of an ordered grain, they can pack together and actually make a configuration of perfect packing. So it would look something like, if this is an ordered grain and these are two disordered grains, that's a unit of perfect packing, okay? But the thing I want you to realize is that if I have bricks, I can make a ground state in a very, very, very degenerate way. If I have coal, which is a favorite example that I've inherited from my postdoc supervisor, Susanne Edwards, then basically it's probably likely that because of the jaggedness that you have a unique ground state. Now I just want you to bear with me a little more, and without going into details, all I really want to tell you is, yes. That is in one of my slides. Can I just come to that in the question? Yours will be the first question I'll take. Okay, but I just don't want to break my thread because I'm getting near the end of my talk and people are falling asleep. So I'm aware of glazed eyes in the audience and I don't want them to be completely glazed. Okay, so what I want to say is that if I actually have rough grains, if I actually have jagged grains, there is a unique ground state which is optimal but not perfect. But for the very same reason, under zero temperature dynamics, it's trivial to retrieve it. Okay, and you know, you can get all the fancy signatures you want, such as logarithmic slowing down and so on. On the other hand, imagine a perfectly packed state of bricks. It's beautiful, it's perfectly packed, and as soon as you shake it a bit, it's lost forever. Okay, and that's something that we find, and that's really a consequence of the fact that in the updating dynamics, HN can vanish, so even at zero temperatures, stochasticity is introduced, and the non-trivial steady state, and this is one of the take-home messages of this talk, that you get if you keep vibrating the this column at arbitrarily low, in fact zero temperatures, is that you can see unbounded fluctuations of HN, which go as A times, which is on constant time, N to the 2/3, okay, which really, if you think about what it is, it's arbitrary fluctuations of HN, which is fluctuations of density. So without really trying to get there, we were able to say that, you know, the regular grains vibrated at very, very low temperatures or zero temperatures are not able to retrieve them, but what they can do is they can generate density fluctuations. And these were the, to our knowledge, the first, and there's been a theoretical model of them, although they were found in experiment a long time ago. Interestingly, the exponent 2/3 suggests to us that grain displacements are anti-correlated. And here I'm sort of, you know, appealing to that old picture that I showed you, the computer simulations, where again we had an indication that near jamming, grain displacements are anti-correlated. And this, if you like, is one of the most key results. All of you who are asleep, please wake up just for this and go to sleep again. What we've done here is to say that if I were to take all the configurations I get with zero temperature vibration for regular epsilon, if I were to plot the microscopic entropy, why am I calling it the microscopic entropy? Because 2 to the 12 multiplies P of C. P of C is just the probability of a configuration, okay, which where C is a configuration which is defined in some kind of a lexicographical way, which is a fancy way of saying it's all A's or all A's in one B and so on and so on. And what we get is this very strange fractal-looking graph, okay? And so what we see immediately is that the microscopic entropy has an extremely rugged form. And if you think about it, this is exactly what you would expect near jamming, because essentially those states, the system is constrained, those states which are really well-packed should be favored, and in fact they are. If you see the red dots on top of there, you see that those are the ground states of the system, in fact. So what's happening to the system? These regular grains are being vibrated, they find for a second their perfect state of packing, and then they're forced out of it. And then they go back again and go back and forth. So the most occupied states are, in fact, the ground state. And the lovely thing, as far as I'm concerned about this, is that although microscopically it does exactly what you would expect, which says that some configurations are favored compared to others, macroscopically the entropy is flat in agreement with Edwards. Okay? This one? Okay, it's just a labeling of, I have a column, right? So if I say A is a flat orientation and B is an up orientation, then it's just labeled lexicographically. So you have all A's in one B, all A's in two B's, you know, and so on. So it's just...
What happens when the system size grows? I mean, my question is actually whether those...
Well, you see, no, the fact is this, that, you see, this is all analytical, by the way, okay? The fact is this, that this is a very microscopic portion, 2 to the 12, okay, of the entropy. So the system size, when it's whatever the value, we're already in the regime which is asymptotic, which means that the macroscopic entropy is flat. I mean, this is a very small correction. So you can say that as the system size grows even more, it's some, I can give you the number for it later, but it's, you know, it will grow with a very small power of n, this thing. Okay, so it's always going to be a very microscopic version of the entropy, portion of the entropy.
When you say it's analytic, you mean that there is a function which does this?
Well, what I'm saying is that the model is fully analytic, and then you plot what, you can define the entropy, and then you just solve for that, and you just put that, you know, you just plot that. Uh-huh. Because S is defined as P log P, overall configurations. Okay. Okay, and this is the last slide. Yes, it is the last slide. And okay, I will just leave it at this and say that if you go into low temperatures instead of zero temperatures, you get intermittency of the surface. So I hope that hasn't taken too much of anyone's time, and I thank you all for your attention. And now I'm up for grabs. So.
Can I say we've been going for an hour and a half? someone needs to escape fresh air, back off. But there was one question, and one person absolutely promised.
Yes.
Let me put the question in the right way.
Yeah.
I'm Sergio Araguer, the many movers. Essentially, the general idea, generally, is the same. You have any stochastic process to define the tap, and afterwards you have the relaxation.
Sure.
What bothers me is the fact that, you have the stochastic process, you have a rule for the transition you wrote there as a, energy barrier transition.
Wait a minute. I thought you were asking me a question about...
I want to explain the question. And then, afterwards, just allow the system to freely relax in some sense. I want to know how many transitions do you allow to know whether you are or not in the weak tapping limit, in what you call the low temperature limit or something like that.
Okay. In which model?
In the last one.
In the last one. In the last one. Okay. So, in the last one, let me just come very quickly to that. In fact, this is the slide that I went through.
That one.
I didn't put it here, but essentially it's a model. It's something. This one is this the one you meant?
No.
Okay, no, but in the last one, you see, it's not even a question of going through many things like in the weak tapping limit. In this model, all you have is an intensity of vibration gamma, which is actually...
It's controlling the data.
Which is here.
There.
Yes.
How many transitions do you allow during the tap? And after...
Oh, I see what you're saying. So what you do is you essentially say that you have a system of N grains, okay? And you take... It's sort of random sequential. You just take one and you say, is it aligned with its local field?
Yeah.
Okay? And if it isn't, then you have two possibilities. If gamma is enough to misalign it, then it has a possibility of doing that. If it is something that brings it into an alignment, it will definitely do that. Okay? And then, it just follows on completely. In fact, it's completely deterministic, because the sigma n equals sine n rule is followed completely. The grain above you just tells you what your local field is, and you just do what. And the lower temperature stuff, which I showed at the end, is where you have some stochasticity. Because
it update globally for each tap.
Absolutely, yeah, sure. And when you've done it, n times in a sample of n grains and in no particular order, then that's one cycle. People are fidgeting. Sorry. I apologize for putting everyone through this, but it's the quickest I could be. So, thank you.